Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO, and today it's my pleasure to welcome back to the program one of my favorite writers and one of my favorite guests, Ian Rankin. Hello, Ian.
How are you doing, Vic?
Much better now, thank you. Ian, I always look forward to your new books because it gives me an excuse to talk to you, and I always pray they'll send you on book tour to the United States. And here you are speaking to us from Houston, from the beautiful hotel what?
Zaza. It's a very artistic hotel. It's got lots of moody black and white photographs and paintings everywhere.
Sounds like something you'd find in New York.
It does, except it's got windows with views, which you tend not to find so much in New York. On the New York stage of this trip, my view was off a stone, you know, a kind of brick wall, approximately 6 feet away from the window.
Wow, I've had that same view.
Yeah, I think a lot of people who've been to New York have had that view.
Ian, a lot of people were brokenhearted when Inspector John Rebus retired, your long-running series that lasted 20 years, but he reached mandatory retirement age. What could you do?
Exactly. It isn't that I was fed up with him or had really run out of things for him to say. I still like the guy. His voice is still inside my head. I'm not sure we've absolutely seen the last of him, but the books had, you know, made a virtue out of the fact that they existed in real time, so they could evolve. They could show how Scotland was changing as a nation and how the UK was changing. And so when I found out from a cop friend that at 60 the detective has to retire, I decided he would retire, even though questions were asked in the Parliament building. A member of the Scottish Parliament asked the Justice Minister if they could change the retirement age so that my fictional detective could keep going. I got a lot of hate mail from real-life detectives about that one.
Was that a Labour politician by any chance?
It was indeed, yeah, the Labour politician. Helen Eady, she's called. She's from the same part of Scotland as me, and she's a huge Rebus fan, and she just was brokenhearted. But, you know, these things happen, and he's not dead. He's just resting, and we may see him again. And, you know, meantime, there's Malcolm Fox to play with.
Yes, you've just put out a new book, a new series, is it?
Hopefully a series, but, you know, I never plan these things too well. I've got the first draft of the second Fox novel with me in the States. I'm doing some revisions to it. Hopefully we'll see at least two books with him.
This book is called The Complaints, and The Complaints is sort of like our internal review over here, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, it's basically the cops who investigate other cops. And what I liked about that setup was, well, two things, really. One was you'd have to be a very different kind of cop from Rebus to do that job. You know, Rebus is a maverick, a rule breaker. He doesn't mind bending the rules, stepping over the line. If you're going to be a complaints cop, an internal affairs cop, then you have to toe the line. You have to work well in a small team. You've got to be whiter than white, you know. So I thought these are the guys who would investigate Rebus. So it meant that in inventing Malcolm Fox, I could be sure that the readers weren't going to think they were getting Rebus with a different name, that Malcolm would have to be philosophically, psychologically, would have to be a very different kind of person from Rebus. Another thing is that everybody hates them. Everybody hates the complaints department, you know. I mean, even other cops hate them. Villains hate them. Everybody hates them. So it was a chance to try and empathize with a group of people who normally nobody likes.
And Malcolm Fox, or Foxy, is a denizen of the same city where Rebus spent all his time and where you live.
Yeah. I mean, the books, you know, are still about Edinburgh. The Edinburgh is still the central character in the books. And what happened was we had this financial crash, as everybody knows, but Edinburgh is a small city, 500,000 people, but 20% of the jobs revolve around the finance industry. With the bank, the Royal Bank of Scotland had grown hugely in size and importance to be one of the top five international banks, and then suddenly was 12 hours away from going bust. And I wanted to write about that. I wanted to write about the impact that would have had on the city of Edinburgh, and also just in general, this notion that we put so much faith in these guys who are making money from nothing. You know, Edinburgh has no industry. I mean, we don't make anything physical. We don't make ships and cars or anything like that. We just push money around. And I just wanted to talk about that. What that, you know, what that can do to an economy, and what can happen to that economy if that process fails. And I thought a good way of doing that is to write another detective novel. I mean, I do think that the detective is the premier character in fiction if you want to talk about the problems that we have in society.
Ian Rankin joins us. His new novel is The Complaints, and he's in the U.S. on book tour from his native Scotland. And I was reading The Complaints, and I think somewhere in there you cite the statistic that there's only one murder a month in Edinburgh. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if that. It's a very small, predominantly safe city. And if you go back and flick through the Rebus novels, you'll find the body count is particularly low. There's maybe one or two deaths per book, and each book represents a year of Rebus's life. Ironically, a few days after I left Scotland to come to the States, there was a murder literally round the corner from my street. This is a very nice, as you might say, a Tony neighborhood.
Merchiston Crescent?
Yeah.
Yes.
And they get maybe one murder every 4 or 5 years. And I've been in that area 8 years now. And if I had two murders, you know, around the corner, I'm beginning to think it's me. You know, I'm bringing the neighborhood down.
Well, you've got a good alibi, though.
I've got right. But everybody's picking it apart already, you know.
Yes. According to the Express this morning, a large number of uniformed police officers conducted house-to-house inquiries and studied the contents of refuse bins. I bet you wish you were there.
It sounds ghoulish, Vic. It sounds hellish, ghoulish, but I do wish I was there. Uh-huh. The last time there was a murder in the neighborhood, a journalist phoned me up and said, Ian, you know, have you got anything to say about this? And I said, well, I didn't do it. That's number one thing I'd like to say. But after I put the phone down, I thought, oh, I've got to go take a look. I've never been to a murder scene. So I went around the corner, and sure enough, there were the cops, there was a crime scene tape, there was the scene of crime officers all dressed up in their overalls and stuff. You know, next day in the newspapers, it was reported that ghoulish crime writer Ian Rankin had been on the scene to record, you know, the details. So kind of maybe it's good I'm not there, otherwise I'd just get some more bad press, and I don't need any more bad press back in Edinburgh.
Well, it's funny. Well, it's not funny, but I Googled you before the interview, and I saw these articles, and I thought, oh, man, a murder just down the street. It was like a Victorian villa that had been turned into flats, I understand.
Yeah, yes. I mean, all the homes around there are late 19th century, huge, solid Victorian, as you say, villas and tenement buildings. It's a beautiful area. You know, it's very leafy, lots of trees. There's a huge piece of parkland nearby. The canal is nearby. You know, predominantly a very safe place to live and a very safe place to raise your kids. But, you know, bad things happen everywhere, you know. It isn't always to do with the neighborhood. It's to do with human nature. And sometimes human nature insists that we do terrible things to each other.
I've read quite a few of the Rebus books, and I was struck by this new book, how we get such a wonderful travelogue of Edinburgh in this particular book. You really cover some ground in this new one.
Well, Edinburgh's I find it an absolutely fascinating city. I mean, it's my home, but I didn't grow up there. I moved there when I was 18 to attend university, and okay, I've lived half my life there now, on and off. But, you know, it still is revealing itself to me slowly and by degrees. You know, every time I kind of smugly think, okay, I know this city now. I know it. I know what makes it work. I know what makes it tick. Something else happens that makes me think I don't know the place at all. I've got a very superficial understanding of it. And that's a small city. As I say, it's a city of 500,000 people. So, you know, trying to understand bigger, complex urban environments, it must be almost impossible, because if I can't, you know, if after 20 books I still don't know the place I'm writing about, what hope is there for me?
And of course, we make the inevitable comparisons as readers between Rebus and Fox, and we think, now how did Ian imagine this new character, because they are so different.
Well, I was kind of lucky in that, you know, during discussions with people who had worked in internal affairs in different areas of Scotland, I did come to the conclusion that psychologically, philosophically, they would be very different to Rebus. They couldn't be the same kind of people as him. And it's nice to be able to write about someone who has good, strong family values, who's very close to his father, very close to his sister, who has a group of friends. He's not a loner. I mean, he lives alone, but he's not attitudinally a loner in the way that Rebus is. He's quite happy with his lot, and he's on the side of the angels. You know, he he thinks, how can the police do their job if the public don't trust us to police our own cops and bring them to justice when they cross over the line? So he's got a lot of virtues, Malcolm. I like him a lot as a human being. You know, I mean, and he's also, I always got the feeling that Rebus would hate me if he ever met me. You know, we couldn't stand and talk for more than 5 minutes because he would just get bored and walk away. Whereas Malcolm, I think I empathize much more with him. I think I'm more like him. And so I do like spending time with him. But it's not to say that we've seen the last of Rebus, because they have changed the retirement age since I wrote the final Rebus book.
No.
And now as a cop in Scotland, you can now work until you're 65 or even 70. So I know what Rebus is doing. He's working cold cases as a civilian, working within the police department. That's a real-life unit that I mentioned in the final Rebus book as a possibility he might go and work for them. That's what he's doing. And any time I feel like it, and any time the plot and the theme are suitable for a Rebus novel, I know the old guy can come back again.
Well, you managed to resist the temptation for Rebus or Siobhan to make cameo appearances in this new novel, didn't you?
Well, Siobhan was in the first draft.
Okay.
But she had been reduced to a secondary character, and there wasn't much I could do with her. And I felt she really deserves more than that. During the course of the Rebus novels, his colleague Siobhan, who starts off really as just a means of asking the questions of Rebus that the reader wants answers to, you know, hey, Rebus, how did you work that out? You know, she suddenly took on a personality of her own and became her own person, and I just loved her to bits. And so I gave her more and more to do in the books. And another possibility, even if Rebus doesn't come back, is for me to give her a full-length book and let the reader spend some more time with her. What held me back for a while was the fact that there's no tradition of men writing well about women in mystery fiction. There just isn't. You know, women write well about men, but men don't always write well about women. And so that kind of held me back until female crime writers, but also cops, female cops would say, you know, I quite like Siobhan. She's interesting and she's fairly realistic and, you know, can we get some more of her? So, yeah, we might see a lot more of her in the future.
Do you have any theories as to why that is?
That men don't write well about women?
Uh-huh.
I think in general they don't. I mean, I think in general in literature, women are much better. I think they're just, they're more psychologically acute, perhaps, or psychologically attuned. But, you know, definitely in crime fiction, we think nothing of Agatha Christie having Hercule Poirot or Ruth Rendell or P.D. James or whoever it happens to be having a male hero. But until very recently, you didn't see it with male writers. And ironically, it's a guy two doors away from me, two houses away in Edinburgh, who in some ways broke the mold, and that's Alexander McCall Smith with the Mama Ramotswe books. When he first started publishing those, people were very surprised when this middle-aged professorial guy walked into the room because they thought the person who wrote these books would have to be, I don't know, a black African female detective. I don't know. But he got inside the head of that character and also that culture very, very well. But, you know, I can't think of too many other people who've done it really successfully over a series of books.
Ian Rankin joins us. His new novel is The Complaints. And Malcolm Fox is the main character. But you have another character in this book who is fairly well-developed. They spend a lot of time together.
Yeah, Breck. Name taken from Robert Louis Stevenson's novel Kidnapped. Yeah, he's one of these guys that right up until the very end of the book, I wasn't sure if he was a good guy or a bad guy. It could have gone either way. I mean, it was almost a case of tossing a coin. I think I got my wife to read two separate versions of the last couple of chapters, and she got to choose which way she wanted Malcolm Breck to turn out. Sadly, the second book, the first draft that I've done, there is no room for him, mainly because the majority of the book takes place outside Edinburgh for a change. Because one of the nice things about the Internal Affairs Department is that unlike normal cops, they can travel. They're invited by neighbouring police areas to go and prepare reports on allegations of corruption. So I've decided to take these guys over to the area of Scotland where I grew up. And so they really are kind of fish out of water. You know, not only are they reviled and mistrusted by everyone around them, but also they don't really know the geography. They don't know the landscape. And that was a bit of a challenge for me. I mean, it was nice to kind of stretch the brain a little bit because, you know, I was having to think of new ways to describe small Scottish towns.
I seem to recall that you took Rebus out to your old hometown as well.
Yeah, in a couple of the early books, and one in particular, he goes back to the town where I grew up and where he grew up, and yeah, to solve a missing persons case, and is the son of a a girl he dated. And that was, you know, that was a lot of fun. The problem is, of course, that people don't like it sometimes when you start writing about the places where they live. I mean, the early Rebus books, you know, the complaint I got most often was, this is going to put tourists off coming to Edinburgh. They're going to think it's a place of murder and mayhem. But in fact, ironically, it turns out tourists want to come and see Rebus's Edinburgh. There's a Rebus walking tour that you can do with a guide who takes you around and shows you the various spots where things happened. And I'm, you know, it may be that after the second book is published, I can't go home again, as it were, because when I go back to my hometown, people won't like what I've said about the place. But I will face that problem when I hit it.
So much for the complaints.
Well, you know, I mean, it got to number one in the UK, and it's had some terrific reviews already stateside, so I have no complaints.
Good. Ian Rankin joins us. His new novel is The Complaints, and he's on book tour right now in the U.S.
It's one of these tours where it's a different city every day. I spend more time in airports than I do actually in bookstores, and I'm getting very little time to decompress, you know, or to actually see the country, which is always quite frustrating when you go to these wonderful places, maybe once every 2 or 3 years, and, you know, you see your hotel room, you see the airport, you see the bookstore, if you're lucky, you see a radio station, and then you're straight back onto the plane to the next destination, and you really don't see the country. I'm very lucky, though. I mean, back in 1992, my wife and I spent 6 months out here driving a VW van around with our three-month-old son in the back. And we really got a chance. You need that kind of time if you really want to start seeing the USA. You need at least 6 months.
Didn't you live for a time in France
in
a vineyard?
Yeah, France. I lived for a short time on a vineyard just after I graduated from university. My girlfriend and I stayed on a vineyard, worked there for a few months, and got to like France a lot. So a few years later, when I was just about to make the plunge to become a full-time novelist, she persuaded me that we should go back and actually buy an old ramshackle farmhouse out there, which we duly did, and nearly died several times trying to rebuild it, you know, because we had no skills. Every time I opened the refrigerator, I got an electric shock, because I'd rewired the place wrongly, basically. But yeah, we had a great time. Both our kids were born out there and spent 6 years out there. And my proud claim to fame was that I was the only Scottish crime novelist in the Dordogne.
Ian Rankin joins us. He's the only Scottish crime novelist in Houston at the moment.
Who knows, maybe.
You mentioned that you thought, well, you couldn't spend 20 minutes with Rebus. He's a cantankerous loner. But at least the two of you could have a drink together, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Fox?
Fox doesn't drink. He doesn't drink and he doesn't listen to 60s rock music. So he's a disappointment to me on several fronts. And I wish I'd actually gone the other way and made him a musician. You know, I just wanted to make sure that readers could differentiate between him and Rebus. So I didn't want him to be a drinker. He doesn't smoke. But also I decided he wouldn't listen to music. And I really wish I'd gone the other direction because, as you know, I am like many mystery novelists, I am a frustrated rock star. I would much rather have been in a rock band than become a novelist. And to my chagrin, I've been in Austin yesterday, but of course I just missed the South by Southwest Festival by one day.
Mm-hmm.
So all the musicians were leaving as I was arriving.
Oh, well.
I know. Next time.
That was the only thing about this new book that I missed was you do have some musical references, but they're not what we have learned to anticipate. You mentioned Elbow, and you have some guy pull up, and he's playing an old punk song. What was it, the Skids?
Yeah, local punk band from when I was growing up. That was when I was at school. They were one of them, the guitarist Stuart Adamson, who went on to have big success with a band called Big Country.
Huh?
Yeah, he was 2 years above me at high school. Never knew him. You know, he was like the guys in his year. When you're sort of 15 or 16 and this guy's 17, 18, they're like gods to you. You can't really talk to them unless they talk to you first. But I used to go and watch his band play a lot, first band he was in, the Skids. And, it was nice to get a little mention of them in the book. But no, I know. I mean, out here in the States, if I get any free time at all, the one thing I do is hit the record stores and the CD stores. And I think out of the five cities I've been in so far, I've managed to be in about 9 or 10 record stores, mostly secondhand, looking for old blues stuff, looking for vinyl, I've got a kind of spare suitcase with me just in case, you know, I find stuff. I found a few bits and pieces so far, so I'm happy.
So how's the vinyl collection coming?
I had to get some shelves built. I think I've got to the stage of hiding it from my wife, you know, uh-huh. hoping she's not there when eBay deliveries get made. Uh-huh. It's quite a healthy collection now. I mean, a lot of it is stuff I'm having to rebuy, you know, stuff I bought when I was a teenager and then sold when I had no money and I was at university. Mm-hmm. And I find myself now looking for that stuff again and having to pay ridiculous amounts of money for it.
Bands like Colosseum.
Yeah, all the progressive rock stuff, the early Yes albums, Colosseum for sure. In fact, I saw a couple of their albums a couple of days ago and nearly bought them. But also, you know, sort of early Lou Reed, Velvet Underground stuff, Stones. I gave away Stones albums. I really regret that. But, you know, it's fun, and it's much more fun doing it physically, you know, in the store and just browsing than it is doing it online on a laptop or something. I find that actually quite tedious, not nearly as involving. And, of course, also you don't get the chance to sort of, you know, turn the album over in your hands and have a look at the artwork and everything else. So, yeah, I mean, I'm enjoying the hunt. I think the hunt is as much fun as the actual finding.
Well, it can be so frustrating on eBay when you think you've got the high bid in, mm-hmm. and then at the last second, suddenly someone's willing to pay some ridiculous amount of money. I've seen albums on there going for $3,000 and $4,000, and I say, what?
Yeah.
Who wants that?
Usually Japanese people.
Okay.
The problem with things like eBay is you've got the world is your market. If I walk into a little secondhand record store in Chicago or Boston, Cambridge, Mass., wherever it happens to be, and I'm the only person in the store, then that store is at my disposal. But when you're looking on eBay, every vinyl collector in the world is looking with you.
Hmm.
So you're up against all these people. So, you know, as you say, you can lose out a lot of the time. I think what you have to be careful of is just not overpaying for stuff, because you can get absolutely, you know, you can get focused. You can get in a zone where you say, I'm not going to let that one go. I'll add another $5, another $5. And you just, and as you say, then these things end up going for crazy money.
Uh-huh. Well, we digress.
A little bit.
Ian Rankin joins us. His book is The Complaints, and he is on book tour right now. This book, I don't really want to say too much about it because it takes us on so many twists and turns that even as it opens, you don't really want to say what the circumstances are. Can you give our listeners any kind of a clue?
Fox and his team have been trying to put away a bent cop, and they're kind of getting very close to the conclusion of that. So actually opens almost with them celebrating the end of a case rather than the beginning of a case. It's an unusual mystery novel, I think, in almost nothing happens in that first chapter. It just puts all the pieces on the board and introduces you to the pieces and says, this is who this is. But there's no murder until a little bit of the way into the book. And when that actually comes, it's someone fairly close to Malcolm. It's someone connected to his family. And he is fairly soon, looks like he's in the frame for the murder, or may potentially be. At the same time, he's investigating another cop, a young, energetic cop, and he sees in that guy something he hasn't got. He sees a kind of charisma, an attitude and everything else, and he actually comes to an appreciation of the guy and decides to find out if the guy actually is guilty of a misdemeanor or if he also is being set up. So you've got two guys who basically look like they're being set up for something, having to work together to clear their names. And one of them is very kind of proactive and energetic, and one of them, Fox, is a big bear of a guy who's like he's a professional voyeur who only very reluctantly becomes proactive.
And here we have something that your Rebus fans will recognize, and that's cops working outside of the system because they've kind of been forced out.
Yeah.
That happened to Rebus a lot.
Yeah, it did. Oftentimes the Rebus, he chooses to do that because he doesn't work well as part of an organized team and he's not very good at taking orders or obeying orders. So he tends to go off at a tangent and run his own inquiry parallel to the official police inquiry. And he does that because that's what he likes doing, and because he always gets away with it, you know. In real life, he probably wouldn't get away with it every time. Malcolm does it very reluctantly. He's a passive individual, really. He does a passive job. His job is to watch other people, to do surveillance on them without them knowing that they're under surveillance, quietly and methodically to put together a case and then to present that case. And in this book, he has to become, you know, he has to become a man of action. He has to, if he's going to find out what's going on, he's going to have to do something about it himself, because the police are going to offer him no help at all, partly because he's under suspicion and partly because he is an internal affairs cop and nobody wants to help an internal affairs cop. So he doesn't really know who he can trust. He doesn't know who he can turn to, so he turns to himself. And I think that's interesting, that journey that he ends up going on, from being a very passive voyeur to being someone who has to become a man of action, reluctantly so, is something that, you know, really interested me when I started thinking about his character and the way that I would have to change his character for him to take part in this plot that I was putting together.
One of the things that I really love about your books is how you have slang that maybe people in Edinburgh would understand, but I have to try to figure out what it means, and I love that. And I understand that you have been named to head a labor commission into declining standards of literacy in Scottish schools. Is that right?
Yeah, it's actually, we've delivered the report now. It was last year. No, I mean, it's something I feel very passionately about is literacy, and we do have a huge problem in Scotland, especially with boys, and especially boys when they reach their teens. When they're schooled up until about the age of 12, they do read quite a lot, and then somehow it's not, you know, it's not the kind of thing teenage boys want to be seen doing, is reading books and stuff. So they don't do it, and the literacy does decline. And it was kind of looking into the reasons why that might be and what can we do about it. And one of the problems is that there just aren't as many things that are interesting to teenage boys. When I was a kid, there used to be loads of comic books coming out of Scotland. There was a publisher called DC Thompson, nothing to do with DC Comics in New York. But they had, you know, loads of cheap, freely available comics that came out weekly and were aimed specifically at boys. And I used to get a dozen of them a week, all these different titles. Those were the first things I read. And I do believe that comic, you know, some people look down their nose and say, but, you know, that's not literacy, it's comics. And I go, yeah, but my son, my oldest son, who's now 19, when he was 15, 16, had never read Shakespeare, or not willingly read Shakespeare, until I brought home a comic book version of Macbeth. It was like 150, 200 pages, and he devoured it. He sat on the stairs. He was sitting on the stairs. He sat down next to it. He devoured it. And he came to me in the kitchen, and he said, Dad, that was great. And I said, well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. The play is actually on in Edinburgh just now at the theatre. Would you like to go and see it? And he said, yeah, I'd love to. And he went and sat and watched a Shakespeare play because he'd read a comic. So it's a rung of the ladder, I think is what I'm saying, Vic.
Yeah.
And we shouldn't look down our noses at anything kids are reading. If they're reading, terrific.
Well, Ian, it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
All right, man. It was nice talking to you from sunny Houston.
You've been listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest has been Ian Rankin. His new novel is The Complaints. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week for the program, when my guest will be Jacqueline Winspear. Her latest Maisie Dobbs novel is called A Lesson in Secrets. On the Book Nook. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.